Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me in the first weekend of May 2025. We are moving forward through the spring, although here in Sitka, we've been experiencing kind of showery weather with cool temperatures. A couple of days have been warmer, but many days in recent weeks have seen snow down to below tree line. So we'll see when it really starts to lift with warmer temperatures. But for now, we are still seeing the daylight, the movement of birds, and the growth and greening up of the plants here at sea level around Sitka. Bird-wise, the shorebird migration has been picking up. I expect, well, not every year is the same, but I suspect we'll start seeing more of the smaller shorebirds, the peeps as they're sometimes called, showing up in the coming days. We have, prior to now, over the last couple of weeks, seen many, many black turnstones and surfbirds here locally around Sitka. A few other species showing up, but you never know what you might see this time of year. We are seeing more songbird migrants arriving as well, starting to sing. Set up territories. So if you're getting out and enjoying the plants and animals, the birds migrating, I'd love to know what you're seeing out there, especially if it's something unusual. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop up my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one with a returning guest, Matt Muir. He was in town visiting from his home in Anchorage. Very enthusiastic natural history, iNaturalist person. So we'll go ahead and join the conversation with him, sharing a little bit about the geography of his home area in Anchorage and go on from there.
South of downtown, the first watershed that you get to is Chester Creek. So coming off the Anchorage foothills, and then how it becomes Westchester is they dammed it at one point. The railroad tracks go along the coastal area, the coastal trail, and they created a lagoon. The little signpost says that they created it as a recreation opportunity for families and women of good repute.
I see.
Apparently Anchorage was only attracting women of ill repute at some point. And they, some person in town decided they needed sort of a recreation opportunity for couples to, you know, sort of have parasols and row around a lagoon. So they created Westchester Lagoon, which is a wonderful spot in Anchorage. I think it's actually, if you look at eBird, it's the most birded spot in Anchorage, or at least where people put enter the most lists. There's lots of waterfowl. There's a few shorebirds that come by. Godwits come in. The ones that nest on the other side of Cook Inlet will come in the evening time. And after they've spent their whole day feeding on the mudflats, they'll come in and bathe in the fresh water of Westchester Lagoon, and then fly back over Cook Inlet to go to their nest. So it's a neat spot. It attracts a lot of birds, and it's a great spot to go ice skating in the wintertime. So it's a nice, it's like recreation all year round.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And so you do have tide flats in the area, but they are these like soupy mud flats, kind of glacial silt.
It's all glacial silt right in Anchorage, right? And actually they have a bunch of signs posted that say hazard, do not go out there, because, you know, occasionally people do walk out there and get stuck in the mud. And it's not good with the incoming tide.
And it's a serious tide. Like that's like the, like, is that the bore tide area, or is that a little further up the even?
Yet? It's not quite bore tide area. That's more turning an arm where it gets where it gets a little bit narrow with Kenai Peninsula on the other side. But yeah, it's the same glacial silt
plus
from like Knik Glacier and other stuff around there. So yeah, the closest tide pooling area we have is Whittier. So you know, if you time it right with going across the tunnel, right, because that's a one way tunnel that changes its direction every 30 minutes. It's about an hour and 10 minutes away to Lu Yung Park is a nice spot to go tide pooling in winter, but it's different, right? It doesn't have the same variety of intertidal area that you guys have here.
Nice. Yeah. And so I guess other than that, you're headed down the Kenai Peninsula to more like Homer.
Ketchmack Bay. Yeah. Ketchmack Bay is another wonderful spot to go.
Yeah. So Sitka is a little bit of variety, spice in that. Although I guess, yeah, you were one of the projects you were talking about, since you've been here, is the we'll call it a fin whale project, I guess, which technically is intertidal in a sense, at least seasonally.
It's definitely within the intertidal area. So a fin whale washed up in November in Anchorage, and it was a young female, but still 47 feet long. So fin whales are the second biggest whale in the world after blue whales. I also learned that they are the fastest whale on Earth. And they weren't, it seems like they weren't targeted heavily by whalers. They were quite fast, and for a long time people thought that they were solitary, right? So they were a bit tricky to catch in whaling. And they're much more of a deep water species, so Anchorage is not, and Cook Inlet is not a space for them. They also, it's, again, Cook Inlet's pretty muddy, and so it doesn't have the right prey for them. So it was unusual for one to be there. It washed up dead and made quite a stir around town. And what was really cool about it, it was right on the coastal trail. And at that point, the mud that is usually quite hazardous to be in was all frozen, right? And so anyone and everyone and their dog and their grandma and everyone could go visit the whale. So there was a long string of people to go out and see it. I was actually out of the state when it first washed up. I was quite jealous, actually. I was worried that it would be gone by the time I came back. But, you know, alas, it's still there to this day. Some research, I wasn't sure if it was NOAA or someone from the university, sent people out to take samples right away to see if they could determine what it died from. From my understanding, they still haven't figured that part out. But they took some samples, and then, over time, the amount of visitors that it got smaller and smaller, although my family did go out there Christmas Day. It's only a 20-minute walk from my house, so it's quite convenient. And there was still a crowd of people even on Christmas Day a month later. But then eventually over time, fewer and fewer people went out there. But I would still go every few days. It was it's a nice walk for me. And the Anchorage mudflats in the winter are actually, I find, one of the most calming places to be. It's one of those places that even though it's in convenient walking distance of the city, you get out there and all you hear is the ice, right? The ice flowing, the ice cracking around you. It is a place that it doesn't get very covered with the high tide, but still some, right? So the ice is always changing and moving pretty much every day. And so it's a nice place to go.
So the mud is freezing when it's exposed. Is it thawing again each cycle, or is it it's cold enough that there's, even when it's covered with water, it doesn't really have time to freeze because it's not underwater for that long? Or the water is just that cold, I guess. I don't know.
No, the ice does accumulate. So around the Finway, I think when it showed up in November, I don't think that there was much of an ice layer. I think it was just the mud that was frozen. And then eventually over the months, ensuing months, it did. Maybe it got 2 to 3 feet. I don't know.
On top of the mud. Oh, wow.
And then So it does sort of every high tide would bring another layer of ice on top of it. The whale never got covered entirely, right? Because it's a big animal. But it was maybe covering maybe half of it. And you could see a line of ice on it. We had a very warm winter in Anchorage. And so we didn't get that much snow. And we didn't have that much precipitation. So we didn't... We did not get that much snow, but sometimes it would get entirely covered in white and then melt off. It was pretty much visible and present pretty much the entire winter. 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a plan from a privately owned but public transportation museum in Wasilla that they got it into their heads that they were going to disassemble the whale. They were going to extract the bones and put it back together in this Wasilla Museum as a tourist attraction. And when I first heard of it, I thought, I don't think they're going to be able to do it, right? It seemed to me it was going to be quite the job. This whale was now encased in months of ice, and it did turn out to be too much of a job. They came out there. I think they had a crew from somewhere in the Kenai Peninsula from maybe an undergrad sort of marine science class, and I think they had some other sort of combination of people also helping out. But they weren't able to do it. I went out there on day two of 3 days that they worked at it. They had some four-wheelers and side-by-sides out there, putting some straps on the bones and trying to pull them apart. They had some very enthusiastic young men in there with knives, just in whale goop. It was pretty nasty at that point, right? And they got some rib bones out, and they got both lower jaw bones out, but nothing else. The vertebrae is still out there. You can go walk out there now, and you can see it's about 400 feet out. And so you can see the vertebrae along a line. The skull is still out there, and a lot of the whale. There's a lot of juvenile bald eagles right now and ravens enjoying getting a little bit fat.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, as the mud sinks. I mean, it's interesting to think about because here in Sitka, we don't have to worry about ice. I mean, it gets cold. We get maybe a little surface layer. If you go into some of the bays where there's a freshwater lens, you'll get ice. There's days when it's extra calm that you'll get ice on the surface, even if it's not that cold. But I think it's just so calm, the surface layer could freeze. But yeah, this accumulation of ice thing is kind of, I mean, it makes sense. It's cold, much colder in Anchorage, but it's not something that I really think about. So, yeah, it wasn't even occurring to me that the ice would be accumulating with each tide, that essentially it's affixed to the bottom, so it's not going to float.
Yeah.
And so it just comes up. Not enough time to – there's more ice that forms than melts, essentially, each tide cycle.
So. And then we get – I mean, we have a lot of icebergs too, right?
Oh, okay. That float, so they get locked
in and out, that actually move quite a lot with the tide. So, you know, it's not like turning an arm and cooking like freeze over per se, but
– slushy.
But there's big chunks of ice. And there was actually, after that crew tried to extract the whale, it did get turned cold again, and there was a big chunk of ice that came and rested on top of the whale. So even if they had tried again like a week later, they would have found a fairly good size, a car sized iceberg on the back tail.
Yeah, it's remarkable just to think about dynamics of ice are just this whole other thing. Of course, you go up to the ice pack North Slope kind of area, and then you have even a whole different world of it. But the having sort of vaguely followed along from a very far distance of rearticulation projects here and just hearing about the work in much smaller, well, certainly the killer whale that was rearticulated that's in the Science Center on display. There's a humpback whale, which I don't know if they're done rearticulating it yet, but they've been working on for a couple of years to be on display in the high school. High school science teachers have been working on that here. I don't remember. It was much larger, but I don't think it was 47 feet long. I don't remember actually, but just like the boiling of the bones to get all the stuff out of him and cleaned off, and just like all of this process, like it's very involved. And then to have the pots big enough, because you know these are big bones, to be able to like clean them and that kind of process, it's not for the faint of heart.
I guess the project that they described in the paper, they were going to take the bones and bury them in manure.
Oh, okay.
In manure.
Yeah,
for
so
6 months, they said.
Biological. And
I guess so.
Yeah. Maybe that would have been sufficient. Presumably they looked into it, but yeah.
Who knows? When I was out there, it seemed a little bit comical in terms of the organization of trying to get it out. But it was just a big job. Maybe they'll, who knows? Maybe by the time next fall and winter comes around and they can get out there again, maybe it'll still be there. Who knows? I've been interested to see if any bears will show up as they're now starting to wake up, whether there'll be enough out there or if it'll be – or the meat will be too far gone to attract any bears. But it didn't stink. That was one thing that all winter, right, it was cold enough that it didn't stink. So it was nice to go out there. Or at least I'm not bothered by
that. Right. And I imagine it's frozen. It's like stuff in the refrigerator or freezer, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, it can smell if it's in the refrigerator long enough. But the freezer seems like – so, will be interesting, I guess, to hear about visits from – obviously, the birds have found it. And bears seem like a likely possibility. I don't know if other sort of – scavenging mammals, carnivore mammals might venture out there. But also I'm curious if it'll end up sinking into the mud.
Yeah.
You know, is the tides come and go, and just like whether there'll even be any sign of it, because it doesn't seem like it's going to float away, but maybe it'll just get buried. I don't know how much those sediments are accumulating and shifting over time, how quickly they're. But yeah, I guess you'll have a almost front row seat.
I know. It's true.
Yeah. So it'll be fun. I mean, imagine, maybe next time you visit Sitka, we can hear the whatever happened to that fin whale story. So, that's fun. Well, so on this trip, then you've been, I guess, did some tide pooling. Any particular highlights from so far? I mean, I guess you have one more day here as we're recording this.
It was great to be out with you guys on at the Tom Young cabin. That was just a joy to be out there, and it was just heaven, right? Like, the tides were starting a bit early, so I would get up at sort of 5:30 and wander out there, and really nice to wake up and just being able to stumble out of the cabin and pretty much be in the intertidal from a few feet from the cabin door. And it's always nice to be down here in the intertidal. I think there were so many mink out there. It's almost less the intertidal life. I kept bumping into mink while we were out there, and you know, you get sort of so focused in on what you're looking on under rocks, you can sort of be quiet and sort of be focused on something and not look up for a while. And then several times a mink would almost be within sort of 20 to 30 feet. It'd be sort of surprising. So it was cool to be out there with another mammal, sort of investigating the intertidal. Nudibranchs are always great. It was nice to be with Paul out fishing, and I had never seen a China rockfish before, so nice to see some of those colors. He got a halibut, and we got a parasite, an external parasite in the halibut, which is probably not of much interest to most people, but it's always exciting to see something new.
Yeah, when you're accumulating, or when you enjoy seeing the numbers go up and accumulating species and so forth, it can be a little weird sometimes, for sure, and people can get a little strange about it. But on the other hand, it also encourages an appreciation for things that you're like, oh, this is different, and otherwise you wouldn't pay any attention to. So I think for me, at least, it's a net positive. And I'm probably a little more there are definitely people that are more like, make the number go up than I am. But it is something that I'm aware of, I guess, just in myself and sort of balancing, because I don't want it to become one of those things where it's like the higher number is good and everything else is like a failure or something where I'm not enjoying it and not appreciating. Like the idea is to have motivation to get out and do these things that are meaningful. And so if numbers help me to do that, which they do, and it seems like you're maybe one of those folks as well, then that's great. And if it stops doing that, then it's time to look for something else. But yeah, the parasites on halibut, I think I have that species. It's like a little lice on the halibut.
Yeah, it didn't seem to have a very distinct body. I would have overlooked it without Paul pointing it out. It almost looks like a foam bubble if you're sort of not paying attention to it.
Yeah, but flat and white on the white side of the halibut.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was with him when I got the one that he got a halibut when I was there, and he's like, oh, there's the halibut lice.
Yeah. So. We've caught halibut out of Whittier before and found like leeches, right? But that's a much more noticeable thing, like a worm attached to these marine leeches. I think there's a few of them, but
yeah, I think there's quite a few of them. I found actually at Magic Island one time here in Sitka, they were on a rock, and I was like, these sure look like leeches, but they were just on a rock. They were really small. And I asked him, and they're like, yeah, the aquarist at the Science Center here, I asked him about it. He goes, yeah, sometimes you'll see them in the aquarium. They're just hanging out waiting for something to come along.
On crabs too, right?
I think so, yeah. Sometimes there's some that maybe get in the gills. I can't remember for sure. Or, yeah, I think king crabs have a kind of a leech that's associated with them. Not 100% sure. Marine stuff, especially marine parasites, aren't really my forte, but but yeah, it's no end of things there. And sometimes it's nice when they're associated with the species and you're like, well, this is the thing because it's on a halibut and therefore, but if you just saw it, like, you know, who knows what. But when they have that kind of species association, so it makes it easier because otherwise they're kind of nondescript. But somebody out there has studied them at some point and we can lean on their understanding, I guess.
Yeah. Someone posted recently from Sitka, was it like snailfish larvae that live in crab gills?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That was so cool. I did not imagine that things like crabs have fish parasites inside of them.
Yeah. Yeah. That was news to me as well. That was kind of an interesting little back and forth in the comments of, not that I'm likely to see those ever. I mean, I guess I could, but I don't interact with king crab very often, but it's just like fascinating to know there's those and the rhizocephalan barnacles. I imagine you've heard of those, but maybe not. The ones that basically they're barnacles, but you'd never know it. They look like barnacle larvae when they're larvae. They look very similar. But once they mature, they actually get inside and they take over crabs, especially a haplogaster, which is a kind of relative of king crab. They're the little, you've probably seen them up north, the little hairy crabs. And so these rhizocephalan barnacles, if you peel back, they'll turn males into females and emit the, they don't really turn them into females. They just take them over and they emit the female pheromones to attract other males in. And then they'll like reproduce from within the crab. It's kind of this wild zombie sort of crab thing going on with barnacles. But then it's barnacles and you're like, well, yeah, how did barnacles come to the point where they figured out how to basically completely take over a crab and use the crab's body as its sort of exoskeleton. So, well, I mean, in that case, they literally have an exoskeleton, but, you know, this I don't know what the best way to describe it is, but it's kind of wild and a little bit unsettling, I have to say, in some respects, you know.
Yeah, evolution is both very cool and very creepy. I don't think I told you, but I got one of those. I think it's a barnacle on the hermit crabs that shows up as like a bright red.
Oh, yeah.
Or orangish sort of growth, bulbous growth out of
the hermit crab. Was that an isopod?
Maybe it was an isopod?
There's a parasitic isopods that get into – there's one in hermit crabs. There's one that gets into shrimp as well. It'll be a bulge on the side. And then there's one that gets into the ghost shrimp, which is – you know, there's an introduced species, which is could extirpate the native ghost shrimp. I mean, it seems to
Karen
have done
showed
so.
Me that last trip here.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some folks that were studying. I spoke with – the guy's name is not coming to me right at the moment, but on a few years ago, you know, he had studied them on the West Coast and they were basically extirpated, killed out by this parasitic isopod that would get into both gills and it would basically, couldn't reproduce because the isopods took over their sort of reproduction. And were very effective at, getting into the ghost shrimp. So
sounds kind of nasty.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was an interesting question. They figured they were introduced in the Bay Area at some point and then started moving north. And so the question was, you know, how far? And they're native to the Western Pacific, I guess, over kind of Asia, Japan, kind of that area. And probably came in ballast water or whatever, you know, sort of thing that transported a lot of marine organisms. And that's one of the, you know, I mean, wanting numbers to go up, you know, sometimes you just run into these. Well, we have a sponge here. It's the purple encrusting sponge, you know, it's a Halicona. And the nice thing is, you know, as more experts, I think both are younger and sort of are digital natives, so to speak. And like iNaturalists make sense to them in a way, or are older and are like, okay, there's something here. I see opportunities for this. And so they're coming in and they're studying these groups. Some traditional academic experts, others just people that like, I'm really into this, whatever group it is, I'm going to learn all of them from everywhere. But yeah, sometimes it's just like, well, the sponge in particular, the guy is a guy from California that's been putting, you know, genus on them. He's like, you know, we just can't because we've done some DNA work. There needs to be a lot more work done, both DNA and morphological, because these things also get moved around or have been moved around. So we don't actually know, especially if you're in a harbor area, could be something from a different part of the world. It could be the native species there. But either way, you know, we just don't know enough right now to go beyond genus. So,
yeah, I think I've seen his IDs, and he's got a very polite paragraph of text that he copies and pastes into each one, you know, trying to correct if some people have identified to species in a diplomatic way.
Yeah, yeah, and I appreciate that. Not everybody's diplomatic there. Most people are. My experience has generally been very, very positive. And, you know, I don't always – I do a lot of IDing, but I don't always put reasons because it's just too much to do that all the time. And most people don't really seem to care. In my experience, but if they ask, I'm happy to go and say, here's what I know, you know, and it's really helpful for me. And I'll usually ask, you know, recognizing that about myself, if somebody comes in and puts a different idea, I'll just ask, it's like, is there anything I can do here to like photograph better? Or, you know, what do I need to do in order to understand this a little better? And in my experience, most people are happy to come back when you show interest and like, invest the time in explaining and doing that. And so that's where I really appreciate, because I'm really interested in this local area and knowing whatever's here. But I don't want to learn all the, let's say, chitons of the world to know, you know, this is how you differentiate this one from this other similar species that at least theoretically could, I mean, it's in the North Pacific, but we don't expect it over here. And so there's kind of this nice intersection between people that have very, you know, narrow subject area expertise and somebody like myself who's looking at a very narrow geographic area. And then, you know, the conversations that arise, you know, I think can be certainly are fruitful for me. And I think at times they're helpful for the other folks because they're getting like on the ground, like experience. And I know those of us here in Sitka, Paul being one of them and others, Karen Johnson being another one, are happy. Like if you need collections and you want to, you know, you're doing some work, we're happy to go find stuff for you and send it to you too. So you can help us know what we have basically, because we don't have the expertise to figure that out. And, other than knowing that we just see it, you know, we found it, we see it, it's here. We could tell you a little bit about where we see it and what it's doing, but yeah, we don't know the other things that it's related to or how they're related or how to even tease that apart. It's just not our area. So, and that's just a great way to kind of meet up that way.
I think you guys are great. I always describe Sitka as like the iNaturalist Mecca of Alaska of the state. So, and you guys are great. I got interviewed one time by a reporter. I don't think any of my contributions made it into the print, but she was writing a story for the New York Times. And I think the headline is something like iNaturalist, the friendliest place on the internet.
Oh, I think I saw that one.
Yeah. And I think her take on it, her frame was so many different parts of the internet, social media, message board kind of places, forums, have a tendency to devolve into conflict, right? And particularly sometimes it can break down on political sides. And iNaturalist just, you know, knock on wood, right? Just hasn't done that yet. It hasn't. But and she ended up talking. She had found some people with both liberal and conservative leanings iNaturalist, and you know, interviewed them both and talked to them about why that was. And you know, it was people that through usernames that I recognized on iNaturalist, and I would have had no idea, right, which way they swung politically, conservative or liberal. And I mean, because when you're you know, talking to someone online and the topic of interest that you're both discussing is, you know, whether there are count how many hairs there are on like the bottom of a bumblebee or something, right? It's just politics don't seem to intrude on that discussion. Yeah. And so it was I did sort of like her framing of thinking about like what makes iNaturalist different than other places on the internet where people are. I mean, it is like a form of social media, and why has it so far not undergone the same pressures that other places on the internet have?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I think another contributing factor is how international it is. I don't always know who is, you know, I usually will look at a username, and if they have any, not everybody has, you know, look at their profile. Not everybody has biographical information on their profile, so you don't necessarily know where they're from based on that. I'll often look at their observations to see, but many of the big identifiers in groups are just there to identify. They're interested in seeing the pictures, but they don't really do any observing themselves. So you can't really infer from that where they are from. Sometimes you can, but I know like there's a guy that does a lot of micro algae, we'll just call it, but including diatoms and various things that aren't strictly algae. But I think he's Russian, but he doesn't live in Russia now. He's lived in other European, but you know, you just tag him. I don't even know how good his English is, but you tag him and he'll put a name on the stuff. I've never tried to talk, and you know, there, and so it's just, and there was there's chitin people from Asia and hermit crab people from Asia that are really, and I think several, you know, various people, including some who were just really interested and saw an opportunity to, they wanted to contribute, saw an opportunity that there wasn't really anybody kind of working on a specific group. So they just took it upon themselves to start working through the literature, start working through the IDs and doing their best and gradually really learning, it seems to me at least, a lot. I don't know, maybe an actual expert in those areas would beg to differ in some respects. I don't know, but they certainly seem to have, you know, learned a lot from that process. And there's a lot of opportunity to just look at stuff and practice, really, and get into discussions with people, you know.
Yeah. With the amount of species and just diversity out there, that we're never going to run out of groups where right. people can specialize yeah. in, right? Like, it almost feels like more we're losing that expertise. It's not – that sort of taxonomic depth maybe isn't favored by the degrees in university systems and that sort of thing. So,
well, that's – reason for optimism, I think, because iNaturalist has inspired people that these aren't people who yeah. went through a traditional thing, but they become very interested. I don't, some of them, I think it seems like, I don't remember, but have, you know, developed enough to start publishing papers and describing species and doing, you know, taxonomic work and in much more of a, you know, non-professional capacity. And maybe, you know, maybe it would be good to have lots of positions of professional capacity, sort of positions for that thing and support for that sort of a thing. But also, you know, just having this interest be more democratic in a sense, there's something to be said for that. It seems like to me, at least, I don't know, but yeah. there are corners of iNaturalist taxonomy that I think there are people who are very passionate about yeah. with some disagreements. And I don't usually run into those. I've just heard of them, but it's not about politics. It's about, well, it's not about politics, like American government politics. It's you know, maybe politics within a little lizard group or whatever, sort of things.
Different dynamics that you can have in there. Yeah. yeah. No, it's definitely removed some of the, you know, any – there's no gatekeeping, right?
Right.
Which is some people feel a lot freer and really good in that scenario, and some people are a little bit uneasy and uncomfortable without more sort of individual authorities, right, being able to you know, gatekeeping is maybe people use mostly in the pejorative, but in the right. I guess the non-pejorative, what, like more of a authoritative, what would the word be?
Yeah, you can't. You need to
filter on quality right, or something. Right. Quality checking.
Yeah, yeah. It's helpful to have. Yeah, and it, you know, as with many things, there's trade-offs, and one could go too far. But if anything goes, you know, that's not so helpful. And if there is no but if there's too much gatekeeping and people can't get accepted even though they're doing quality work because they don't have the right letters after their name or pedigree in terms of academics, you know, that's long been a challenge. Although it's kind of interesting the like in the old days, 200 years ago, before it really became so academic, like it was the gentleman scientists, you know, they were basically landed gentry or whatever it was that they were that needed something to do with their time, and they were, you know, some subset of them got into natural history and naturalist stuff, and you know, they didn't have to worry about money or I guess jobs or whatever.
Yeah, no,
it was,
I mean,
kind of a different sort of a scene. So I guess over time, you know, the culture shifts and how it works.
And 2,000, 3,000 years ago, right?
Like, right, yeah.
People who were really good hunters or really good gatherers, right, for their group were probably amazing naturalists, right?
Well, even now, you know, there's some of the folks that I work with, you know, the Bushmen in Africa, Kalahari kind of area, that they don't have written language, they don't read and write, but they're incredible trackers. But, and it's not just the, you know, people think of tracks and they think mammals, but, and they're amazing at that, but it's like everything, knowing where the plants are, knowing all of these things, the insects and so Cyber Tracker, I don't know if you've heard of Cyber Tracker, but yeah. Cyber Tracker. I used to use that before iNaturalist came out. I built my own little Cyber Tracker app to record stuff here. But then iNaturalist kind of took over for that. But, I mean, the genesis of Cyber Tracker was in part to give away like a symbolic way that these trackers who are amazing could interface with sort of modern science sort of culture that requires numbers and data and writing and all of those things. So they would have symbols that they could do, and then they could, you know, record all this information or a fraction of the information that they had, at least, but which was far more than, you know, they were getting otherwise. And it was a nice sort of win-win. Like they had opportunities for work that recognized their skills, and the, you know, the scientists and folks that were trying to understand, probably in many cases, it's large mammal conservation, I would guess, that they were working on, were able to, you know, get information that would have been very difficult to acquire otherwise. So
yeah. Yeah. See, I've had the privilege of being around some of those groups of people, right? And the Aceh people in Paraguay, Hadzabe in Tanzania, San Bushmen in Botswana, sort of during my days more of a field biologist. And I mean, there are some incredible naturalists in there. I would say, though, it's interesting that even in those groups, it's not as if there's some uniform natural history knowledge. There are still in those groups – it's probably a lot higher than people who, like us, get our food from the – you know, go to the grocery store and have roofs over our heads consistently and all that. But, like, still, even in those groups, when you go and you start asking natural history questions, well, they say, oh, well, let me bring you to my cousin, right? Or, like, my uncle is the one or my aunt is the really one who knows these plants or where to look for this animal. And so – you know, I imagine that's been true throughout the history of humanity, right? Is that there has always been variation of the and sort of depth of sort of curiosity and interest of the natural world around us. And even when we were really subsisting on only things on almost only things that we could find around us, there was still like naturalists who went sort of in a very geeky sort of like in-depth, curious way of life, right? About really paying attention to the things around them. And maybe there were groups of the, you know, early humans that were more interested in music and art or the social, more in the social connections of the human group than the rest of us. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, at least. The work that, you know, I've heard somebody that kind of was investigating, you know, some of the like the natural nature connection sort of things. And he's like, it seemed like, you know, just roughly speaking across hunter-gatherer kinds of people that when you were young, you know, during your childhood, you would build relationships with 400 different species. And that was just kind of your baseline education. You know, this is okay. You need this just to be functional. Beyond that, you know, then you would specialize. You might be a hunter, you know, and really get to understand the mammals and their behavior and all of those things. But not really, you know, the herbs and the medicinals and those sorts of things, maybe not so much, you know. And so you would learn the plants, the organisms, plants and animals that were relevant to your sort of specialty. But the other ones you'd kind of have awareness of maybe, but not really in the same way. Because I imagine people, you know, if you're out wandering hunting, then if, you know, somebody's going to send you to get – You're going out that way anyway. You should be gathering, you know, these things that are out there, sorts of things. So it would be helpful to know those kinds of things. But yeah, it is. I mean, compared to what, you know, how many species do most of us know now? I mean, it's hard for me to go back. But that is one of the fascinating things to me about this iNaturalist journey and natural history journey that I've been on in the place that I grew up. And I there are definitely species that I remember from when I was a child. I think that I would I sometimes wonder what would I have if you'd asked me when I was 12, 15, 18, you know, how much do you know here? You know, without you know, just asking me what I thought I knew. And of course, I had no idea how much I didn't know. Like you just don't even know what you don't know sometimes. So you can imagine that, you know, well, I know most of it. You know, there's a few things here and there, but you just have no awareness of things. And so there have been, you know, a number of times over the years where I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember. I have this memory of like the halosecan, the little sea balloons basically that have water squirts out, or varied thrushes. I remember those and sort of the culturally significant birds like robins and eagles and, you know, some of them locally culturally significant. Some of them, you know, more like Western culture talks about robins and books and those sorts of things. So you just get a little bit of that. Seagulls kind of generically, but I remember seeing marble murrelets, but not knowing what they were. We'd go zooming by on the boat and they'd just tip over. And so I just would see them, but I had no idea what they were, or there was no other significance to me other than noticing them. But then coming back and learning the birds here, I'm like, oh, I do remember seeing those, but no end. I don't remember ever seeing shorebirds. I must have seen them. I don't remember seeing juncos. I must have seen them, but I don't remember. And actually, woodpeckers. I don't remember seeing my first woodpecker until I graduated high school. Like the morning I was walking back, I had to have seen them, but they just didn't register as significant to me. And so I don't have any memories of woodpeckers before I had graduated high school. And they're, you know, they're tapping in foam poles. Their sapsuckers are in foam poles here. I did a paper out for 5 years. I had to have seen them, but just don't remember. So, and I probably would have thought I did. That's the thing.
Yeah, for me, I don't. Yeah, no, I think you got to start paying attention. And like for me, it's like the creating the lists that mm-hmm. is what cements a memory for me. Like lists and photos, right? And
yeah.
I think photos even more in particular. So once I got my first digital camera, then I think I started recording. Although I did even before I got a digital camera, I was doing sketchbooks.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
those are also sort of a record, right? Of like, because then you're really paying it. You're starting yeah, to really you're pay gonna, attention.
If you need to sketch it, yeah, you see things that even, yeah, yeah, you have to see what's there.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a way that is enlightening, I guess, to paying attention. Like, it shows you how much you don't. I guess what happens is our mind makes icons and we try to draw what we think we're seeing instead of what's actually there, and it doesn't yeah. work very well.
Yeah, I think my memories of what I can remember knowing about as a kid. So I grew up in Kenai, right? So it's similar to what we were just talking about in Anchorage, muddy Cook Inlet, not great intertidal. What we would go down on class trips to Ketchmack Bay and Homer and across Ketchmack Bay on the other side. And I remember seeing octopus there. I remember going to some sort of camp and getting like a prize for finding the most octopus, which I was extremely proud about. And also I have a physical scar of where me and my buddy, another Matt Tunseth, I'll name and shame him. His job, he was bigger than me. So his job was to lift the rock and my job was to stick my hand in quick and get the gunnels or whatever was hiding underneath the rock. And he lifted one rock and there was a particularly many number or vigorous amount of fish under there. And so in his surprise, he dropped the rock on my finger. And
oh,
so
geez.
I still yeah. have a sort of scar there from doing that. But yeah, I can remember some trips like that.
Did you have like Sea Week? Is that because we had Sea Week here and then 1 week each spring where we would do field trips to the beach in elementary school?
I don't even know. We did. It was a place called China Poot Bay, and we overnighted there.
So, okay. Yeah. So it's a little different. Here we could, of course, just go to the beach. And I remember in first grade going to the Causeway and Halibut Point Rec, Magic Island, where we were earlier today as we were recording this for low tide. So I do. Now that you're mentioning it, I remember hearing about brittle stars, for example, and kind of being like, I could never find anything. It's sort of how it seemed like to me. Everybody else found all the good stuff, and I was just kind of poking around, which kind of doesn't surprise me. I was less sort of ambitious in terms of like active. You know, in many ways, like I'm an active intellectual learner, like in a classroom, but I'm happy to sit there and take in the information, which is not how you find stuff on the beach. Yeah. I mean, you can find some stuff, I guess, that way. But yeah. then also, of course, you know, the little kids making, you're trying to get crabs to fight or whatever. And there, so the shore crabs, I was kind of right. aware of those. And we harvested some fish and shellfish. So I was aware of like clams and that a little bit, but yeah, I mean, I guess that speaks to it. The organisms that you use that are meaningful for food or whatever, you know, in some places and times, including the present for some folks, the medicine and textiles and various things that people use plants for, you get to know those. But there's so much else beyond that that is just not necessarily. And that's where, you know, iNaturalist and just keeping track. And I mean, really, for me, what iNaturalist does is it helps me interface with other people who know stuff so I can learn the stuff. But then it's so much, even if it never did that, but the ability to track stuff and just, you know, keep track of it for myself, it is so much easier than the things I had tried to do on my own before that it's worth it to me. Worth it to me to do that. And so then it's like we're back to the numbers going up, sort of motivation to get out there and explore. And it's, yeah, for me, it's motivating. I've gotten into mosses and liverworts and a lot more intertidal stuff. And part of it's I'm just curious, but that curiosity in itself, it helps to have a little bit of extra push from the, oh, I should go do my observations today, see what I find. So... last time I think, well, speaking of these kind of numbers, you were doing a big year here. Your last visit, I guess it was 2 years ago. I think you were here in the summer, if I remember.
It was August,
August.
So the tail end of the summer. So, yeah, I was trying to do a big year, which for me meant recording the most species in January to December but I was also had some other categories. And so it was not only species, but also new to me species, species that I had never observed before. It was also the number of identifications, right? Not on my observations, but on other people's observations to see how many identifications I could rack up. And then I was trying to also do a streak for an observation every single day, which I had never attempted before. And just the sheer number of observations too, I guess, was the last category to see. So I think I beat all my goals. So I had my previous record was something like 3,500 observations in a year, and I ended up going way past that. I got some 6,500 observations. Beat my species. I forget what my species record was, but it was somewhere over 3,000. And I beat that. The hardest, and I got, did one every day, even through some of the days. Yeah, it felt like a slog. I got one a day.
Anchorage in winter is not, there's obviously things that you can observe, but if you're looking for novelty and diversity, Anchorage in winter is probably not the best place to be.
Yeah, I must admit there were some days where I was not feeling particularly inspired and would go out to a tree and grab a lichen and that would be it for the day. But then the hardest one was the new to me species, right? Mm. Like, birders would call them lifers. And so I needed to get something like 1,130. And so I ended up in the end getting, I just checked right before we talked, so I'd have the number, 1,304.
So a little bit of cushion, but not a
lot. A little bit of cushion, yes. So I got over. So that's about 3.5 new species, new to me species per day, which is not easy. I mean, I'm happy now if I get two or three species that are new to me per day. And that I had to do it on average every day for a year.
Yeah, that's basically impossible if you live in one place and are only going there. Because it's so easy when you start. Like everything's new the first time you do it, right? And then once you've accumulated that, it's this species accumulation curve. It tails off. So
absolutely. You're more of a purist than I am. So you only count, but no.
No, the traveling. So
I traveled a lot.
It's one world, right? So when you travel. So, I mean, people are imagining that you're literally trying to dig out three new species in Anchorage every day of the year. That's not going to work.
Not the case at all. No, it would be like, I did a bit of traveling and, on a good day, you might get sort of like 50 new to you species, right?
Yeah.
Because it's just a totally new area, unlike any other ecosystem that I'd ever been in before. And, I was a bit manic about making observations during the big year. So I'd be looking for like any little weed sprouting out of the sidewalk. I would, normally just walk by. But, that year I would stop and sort of try to get as many as I could.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, you probably don't know this off the top of your head, but were many of them new Alaska species?
Oh, in terms of
just for
Alaska?
The year. Yeah, because I mean, I'm guessing that many, if maybe most of them were from travel overseas, but because you go to the tropics and like getting if you're there for 3 days, getting several hundred new species isn't really because everything's new and there's
new.
A ton of stuff there, and so you don't even have to find the subtle stuff. It's just like all the obvious plants and stuff that are, but also your effort. In my experience, when you just start putting that kind of effort, most of the stuff is common stuff that you're observing, but you're out there more, so you end up and you're starting to, your vision is becoming refined, you're getting more familiar with what's there, and the thing that sticks out is a little different, sticks out a little more to you than it might have. So just curious, like were you getting many Alaska new lifers in Alaska?
I was getting many lifers. I don't know the exact proportion of inside and outside, but I was getting many in part because that trip that I came to Sitka in August of 2023, that was rounding out. We talked about it last time. A trip with Paul Norwood and Preston Williamson. With we started in Juneau and Haines, and then made our way back to Juneau, and then here to Sitka. And both those guys are amazing and very attentive and observant. And so they were showing me a ton of stuff that I had never seen in Alaska before. Preston is particularly good with lichens, and so we were looking at a lot of those lichens. And he was helping me out also in the Anchorage area as well for different lichens. I spent more time with fungi in general, mushrooms and different things that fall.
Oh, right, because there's the little gathering.
There's a fungus festival fest, yeah. in Girdwood and also Cordova. It was, you know, and plants are something that I have to consciously pay attention to, and some people call it plant blindness, right? Yeah. They can see the bugs all around, but they don't actually see the plants that the bugs are sitting on.
I have
a little bit of that, right? That, like, so there was actually probably, and there still is, a ton of plant species that are, some of them very common, that I have my eyes just sort of glaze over and don't recognize. So that year I put some effort into recognizing the plants around me. So I think I did actually get a lot of Alaska Beauty species.
Yeah.
And then on December 31st of that year, I only knew about it a few weeks later, but I had recorded my last new to me species was a wolverine.
Oh, fun. Yeah.
Which I got it on a camera trap, right? One of these things where the animal walks in front and then the camera is remotely is triggered to take a picture and the person doesn't have to be there. And that was awesome, right? I have never in my life seen a wolverine in person, but I count it, right? If I have set up the camera trap in the location. And another iNaturalist friend up near closer to Palmer, Alaska, he had helped me. He traps, but he's also just a really keen naturalist, and he knew of some spots where some wolverines were fairly reliable more often in the spring, but he thought maybe we could get one in during the year in the winter. And one showed up with just a few hours to spare in big year, and I was able to count it. I was really excited for that.
It would be, you know, it is, I mean, it's nice to see things directly, but there's something also satisfying about setting up a camera, you know, trail cam somewhere, you know, camera trap, and especially if you're like you can just do it randomly, but if you're like paying attention to tracks and sign and stuff out there and go, oh, this seems like a good place, and then to watch the behavior, you know, I've had one of my favorite ones was a pool in a bog that I was pretty sure bears were swimming in pretty regularly. It looked like there was but regular is kind of a relative thing, because you think about it, if it was a bear going there every day, it'd just be a big mud pit.
Yeah.
Like the trail and everything. But so, you know, a few times a year might be what it was. But I had been by there and I had seen it. It looked like it had been freshly churned within the last few days, kind of thing. And so I set a trail cam up on that. And one of the things, I did get bears going in there and deer kind of just walking by randomly. But there was a sow and a cubs that were in there. The cubs were kind of playing. The sow was in there and the cup. But then they all look off to the side and then they just like take off, and you're like, oh, what's up? And then like a minute later, this other bear comes walking through, and so clearly from the direction that they'd all looked, you
yeah
know? So clearly, you know, they knew what was coming. Must have caught it on the wind or something. And so that was kind of a fun, just, you know, just seeing the lives of the bears, you know, in their element without really any awareness or concern of anybody kind of disturbing them. I mean, just undisturbed is maybe the way to put that. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it was kind of fun to see that.
I agree with you. I really, really like camera trapping as a hobby, and sort of gotten into it in more so after my big year, and keep acquiring more and more camera traps. I think I'm up to 15 or so. It's maybe becoming a little bit of a problem. But for me, it's like every time I go check it, it's like Christmas, right? Like unwrapping presents you don't know what are inside. Getting the SD card out, you know, they're all digital at this point. When I started, not quite 25 years, but getting on there early on, I started with film.
Oh, wow. Film camera traps.
Yeah. And so those ones you'd only have, like, you know, the max is 36 roll. And
yeah,
I remember bringing them back from places like Bolivia and Peru back to the cars, you know, the film developer, the Kodak development, and at the cars in Kenai, kind of thing, right? And either being very excited or being disappointed, having brought them all that way and seeing, you know, either very cool animals or that, you know, there had been a bush in front of it that had waved in the wind for 36 times,
right,
and that's all there was.
Yeah.
But they're all digital now, and so each time I get just excited like a kid to see what's on there. And I have them all set to video. If I want to take, still pictures from them, I just take the, still frame from them. But I really like the videos to look at animal behavior when people aren't around. I think that is such like a, a cool window into our wildlife is to see what they do when we're not around, when they're not either when we have a chance to look at them in person and they're not paying attention to us, or things like camera traps give that all the time. And sometimes they're comical, right? Like moose doing just like silly. I mean, they just get it almost like they have a bee in their bonnet or something, or running in circles. And, you know, who knows what they're doing? And I've had lynx come up and start using a stick in front of it as a scent marking post, and you can, you know, see them calling. And wolverines, I've had brown bears show up and then sort of rest in the grass in the background in the view, and then see moose come, and they're looking at the moose across the sort of bog. Sorry, they're looking at the bear laying yeah. down in the grass on the other side of a bog. I've had goshawks show up at bait and battling each other in the air in the video, which is pretty
wow.
cool.
Yeah.
Martins coming and playing with also some bait. What else have I got? Yeah, we're trying to get as many species as I can.
Oh, nice. Traps. Well, and so are there places, if folks are curious about what you're finding on your can traps, are they online anywhere? Or?
I'm posting them all on iNaturalist. I hope okay. to start a YouTube channel this year.
All right.
That's what I'd like to get into, is to start showing them that way. You can't post videos very easily on iNaturalist
right.
yet. And
yeah.
so I want to start putting together some compilation videos. I got just in March, I got a pack of seven wolves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just and this is the Anchorage foothills. So they must be pretty savvy wolves to not get too much attention from people, to just be on that really the edge of urban Alaska.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. If you when you get the YouTube channel going, if you let me know, I'll put a link when I post this on my website. But yeah, it is fascinating. I've kind of gotten out of the habit of I had trail cam up for several years, but I've got some places I want to set up some trail cams, and we'll see if I can make it there off the road system. So not as easy for me to get to, but the curiosity and seeing what's going on with the animals out there. So. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time here. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up?
No, thank you. Thank you always. This is my favorite radio station, Alaska. It's the only one that invites me back to talk.
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. It's always fun to hear what you're doing out there, you know, and so much in nature. And I always appreciate the it seems like we inevitably talk a fair bit about iNaturalist. Of course, that's where we met. And you always, you know, you seem like one of those other sort of data junkies that's like, oh, let's see how the things, and you've done some nice extensive write-ups on kind of how iNaturalist in Alaska, how people are data showing up and those sort
yeah,
of things. It's always
absolutely.
Enjoyable.
I think the next time we talk, we'll be able to talk about that collectively we will have passed 10,000
oh, yeah.
species in
that's
Alaska.
That's probably this year,
unique
huh?
taxa, probably this yeah. year. So
we'll yeah, we're
to,
getting
we'll
there.
Do it again.
Yeah, my personal. I think I'll get to. I should surpass 3,000 taxa this year, pretty easily in Alaska.
Total.
Actually, probably in Sitka by the end of this year. We'll see, but I should be able to.
Which is
we'll
just
see. But
awesome
yeah.
for you.
Yeah,
guys.
It's
like
fun.
for one person to get 30% of all the species.
Oh well, yeah,
recorded across the whole state on this website is pretty cool.
Yeah, and Paul already has. I don't know if he's passed 3,000 for Alaska yet, but he's getting close. He definitely has more things identified as species than I do now in Alaska. So.
Yeah.
He's that trip with you and Preston, I think, boosted his because getting out with other people. I always have a mixed feeling because like I'm fussy about photos, so having a bunch of other people around makes it harder. But you often see so much more when there's other people around.
Yeah.
So there's trade offs, but it is a lot of fun to get out. Well, yeah, thanks for coming in. I'll look forward to whenever you come back again for another low tide series, maybe during herring season. I don't know.
I would love to.
Yeah, when the herring eggs are fresh instead of smelly.
Yeah, they're a bit smelly right now, but it's fun to see them.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Matt. You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with visiting nature enthusiast Matt Muir. I want to thank him for taking some time to visit with me. And thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can check out my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCW Sitka.